Okay.
When we close our eyes in meditation, we look inwards, it can be a very startling experience. The first thing that we notice is just how busy our minds are. It's a little bit like when you put a stick in the water, and you might have thought that the water wasn't moving by a dock, but then when you put a stick in the water, you suddenly see the wake, and you notice how much the water is moving. Or if you throw a leaf in the water and it starts moving away, you have an idea suddenly about just how much energy and motion there is in the water. And there's nothing like trying to follow or focus on a fixed object like the breath or the body to bring awareness to just how much churning and motion and stuff there's going on in the mind. Of course, there's all these random perceptions. There are physical feelings, gut feelings. There's ambient physical feelings. The difference between the two is gut feelings are emotional feelings, as ambient feelings are just pains and aches. There is the feeling of the breath itself, the movement in the body. There's then, of course, the bigger issues of the thoughts and the thought worlds. The Buddha said we lived in many, many worlds. He used the word lokas. By which he meant there's the world of past experiences that we can recreate in our minds. Then there's the world of fantasies, things that could be going on right now but aren't. We have in our minds, each of us, a simulator that can simulate things that aren't happening. We can imagine things. We can simulate future, possible future, things that we're worried about happening or dreading. We can have the inner world too, the world that arises when we close our eyes and meditate. And then finally, there's the world that appears when we open our eyes and we look around and we aren't away in some simulated reality. Now, all these worlds, the Buddha used the same word, loka. He didn't say that there was something called objective reality and then there were fantasies. He used the same word, loka, which meant a fabrication. And by that he means that even what we consider to be reality, when we're wide awake and looking around and noticing what's going on all around us, the Buddha contended that there's a deeply subjective nature to everything we experience. And this is, of course, a huge philosophical debate that's been going on for thousands of years. On the one hand, some people, the logical positivists and the objectivists and some scientists maintain that the empiricists believe that we can observe reality without subjectively filtering it or distorting it, that we can experience the world with a reasonable degree of accuracy. And then, of course, there's the idealists, the German idealists, the phenomenologists, the postmodernists, and more in this camp, the Buddha himself, who believe that everything we see and experience is definitely distorted. And the Buddha didn't fall entirely into the subjective camp. He believed that the world we experience, even the one that we believe is reality, is close enough to what's out there that we don't bump into the furniture, we don't get hit by cars, hopefully. We don't walk into walls most of the time. So there is a certain degree of accuracy to what we experience. But on the other hand, there's always a degree of distortion as well. And if we forget that, if we tend to think that, oh, what I'm experiencing, what I'm thinking is real, we tend to get in a lot of trouble. That's the first part of the talk I'm going to give tonight, which is how to judge which thoughts are worthwhile, which thought worlds and which thoughts are worth listening to, and how to judge when thoughts aren't worth listening to. In other words, how do we, because our thoughts seem to be ours, and they're happening inside of our minds, and they're very close to us. It can be very, very difficult to know the difference between a thought that's worth following and a thought that's going to cause us stress and suffering. And the Buddha gave many, many tools for ending obsessive thoughts, but before we even get to those tools, some of which I'll mention tonight, but before we even get to the tools of how do you end obsessive thoughts, how do you end thoughts that are causing us suffering, the first question is, well, which ones are the thoughts that I should avoid, and which ones are the thoughts that I should listen to? After all, the Dhamma that the Buddha taught is a series of thoughts. The Buddha said that there are, for example, in the way we relate to other people in the world, being compassionate is almost invariably skillful. Thinking about how to help other people, how to be generous. Thinking about how to be appreciative of when somebody has done something skillful. Thinking about gratitude, to feel instead of living in all the things that I wish I had, focusing the mind on the things that I have acquired skillfully. These are very, very skillful things to think and to focus the mind on. So there are many thoughts that the Buddha said are very, very worthwhile. He also said that reflecting on karma, which is seeing which actions I've taken and what skillful results are, is a very wise thing to think about. When observing other people, the Buddha said we should watch other people. See if they're virtuous. In other words, they don't kill or steal or lie. See if they're consistent. Are they calm and friendly most of the time? Or are they liable to suddenly, out of the blue every day, explode or fall apart in stress and agitation? Do they seem to be people who understand that their suffering is largely caused by their own actions? These are the things we observe, and when we find people that are skillful, it's great to be around them and to learn from the skillful things they do, and on the occasion that they cause themselves suffering, see what actions they've taken that haven't worked out. So these are some skillful ways to use our mind, but there's also many, many times that we use our minds unskillfully. One of my favorite teachers says that the reason we find cartoons so compelling and comic books so compelling is because these are the closest analogies to the way the mind works. You'll notice that the colors are a little bit off in cartoons, and in cartoons, the hero is always drawn a little bit bigger and a little bit more muscular. If you ever look at an old Superman or Batman comic book, they're always a little bit more muscular and bigger than everybody else. And in our own thoughts, even though we think we live in reality most of the time, our thoughts about ourselves, we're always a little bit more important, a little bit more central, a little bit more in the middle of everything than we really are, right? We tend to think that everybody's looking at us. If somebody stops right before us, out of the blue, they're doing it to us. They don't walk fast enough, what's the matter with them? On the other hand, if we're walking slower than they are and they want to get past us, what's the matter with them? So everything is happening, it feels, to us. So in the same way that cartoons are distortions where the heroes and the villains are always drawn a little bit more carefully, with a little bit more largeness and more importance and more emphasis, so in our minds are ourselves and the people that we are avoiding or the people that we're lusting after are drawn bigger in our minds, and we have a much more central role in the world than we really do. It's very funny how many people I've met over the years who are absolutely convinced that they are the ones holding where whatever business they work for or together. Oh, if they ever let go of me, this place would fall apart. I always find that humorous. In my experience of capitalism, that's rarely the case. I rarely see businesses fall apart when I or other people have been laid off. It just seems to keep on chugging along, that capitalism. So the role that we assigned ourselves and how important we think is always exaggerated. I tend to think that this explains why animated films are by far and away the most popular films, because I think they're very similar to the way our minds work. They have that sense of exaggerated reality, that sense of distorted, sort of comic booky type view of the world that's very similar to the way we view our own lives. And yes, when we think about ourselves, the comic book nature of our thoughts and perceptions grow infinitely. If you want to notice, you'll find that when you don't think about yourself and you think about something else, the thoughts tend to become a little bit more subtler and less dramatic. But once we pour the magic self lotion on our thoughts, my goodness, how dramatic everything becomes. How much life and death issues suddenly pop out. So, I'm going to go over the quick tests for which thoughts we should listen to and which thoughts and thought worlds we should consider abandoning. The first the Buddha said is use the test of that we implement for right speech, which is not only should we say things that we believe to be true, but we should also say things that we know are going to lead somewhere skillful to lasting happiness or some place that's not harmful. And we should only say things at the appropriate time. There are some times where something's true and we know that it's useful, but it's not the right time to say it. For example, when you're meditating, it's not the time to say something. Or when somebody's hurt or really distraught, it's not the time to tell them that they're an alcoholic. You might want to wait. So those are the three tests for right speech. And I've found that these are excellent, as the Buddha also said, are excellent, excellent tools for judging which thoughts. Most people only judge our thoughts in terms of whether they seem true or not. And a lot of the inner debate that leads to obsession in the mind is where we have a little back and forth in our minds about whether this worry is likely to happen or not. So we go back and forth, this could happen, I could get fired, but maybe I won't get fired because they need me so much, but maybe they're downsizing and I've seen other people get laid off, but I've been there for so long and whatever. So we have this back and forth about the likelihood of the truthness of our thought. But we don't actually bring in the other two factors, which is ever worrying about what might happen in the future ever a skillful practice? Almost never. If you reflect on the past of all the times that you sat around worrying about what might happen, ask yourself, did this effort ever lead to good results? Did it ever make you prepared for that terrible outcome, which probably didn't happen? Wouldn't you have been prepared if you didn't think about it to begin with and just went with, as they said, the flow and just reacted as you would have reacted naturally? Did all the worry that you spent in your life, can you remember it now? And if you do remember the things you worried about, did all this worry, all this planning, all this living in possible outcomes ever lead to good results? This is called reflection on karma. And it's almost invariably, we learn when we look at it this way, that this kind of thinking never brings skillful results. Another kind of thinking that never brings skillful results, as I've talked about in the past, I won't go over it too much, but trying to worry about what other people are thinking about us. Why is this a complete waste of time? Well, first of all, this might be surprising, but other people's thoughts change all the time. So even if they're irritated with you one moment, knowing that doesn't mean they'll always be irritated. B, what other people think is not any more true than what you're thinking. So even if they are irritated with you, that doesn't mean you've done anything wrong necessarily. In fact, the Buddha said there will be people pissed off at us when we speak too much, too little, or just the right amount. There's always going to be somebody who doesn't approve. The greatest artists in the world have all had their naysayers and critics. There's never been an artist who's had universal critical acclaim for a wonderful movie or exhibition. So why should you ever get it? You're not going to. So give up on it. The truth is, the Buddha said, don't follow what the masses say or what your acquaintances say. If you do follow or seek advice, make sure it's from a wise spiritual practitioner. But before you do that, first check it against just the virtuous foundations of the path, which is make sure you're not causing harm, you're not trying to hurt someone, you're not trying to steal or lie. If you followed that pathway, chances are you're in pretty good shape, as long as your intentions are not leading towards trying to cause harm to anyone else. So these are the three. And of course, finally, ask yourself, is it important that I think this thought now? Do I have all the information? Absolutely all the information I would need to picture the most accurate possible picture of whatever I'm thinking about? Or is there more information going to come in the future? If there is, then it's not the right time to think it. If you're trying to achieve calm or peace, like before falling asleep or before doing something else that requires your attention, then it's not the right time. If you're meditating, it's not the right time. If you're engaged in conversation, then it's not the right time. There are only certain times where it's worthwhile engaging in a fantasy or a flight of thoughts about what might happen or what did happen or what could have happened or what should have happened or what would have happened if we lived in a perfect world. So, in fact, the Buddha said most of the time the safest thoughts are the ones about what are happening right here and right now. Another set of tests is one of my favorite. And this is, I find, a very skillful test for whether thoughts are useful or not. The Buddha had what he was an internal tempter in his mind called Mara. Some people think that Mara was actually an external God, but if you read the text closely, it's very clear that Mara was the Buddha's word for his own unskillful inner voices. The brain is like a committee. We've all got skillful voices and we've all got unskillful voices inside of our minds. And the trick is getting to know what your inner unskillful voices sound like. Sometimes they sound very reasonable. I'm going to actually quote an example of two times the Buddha's inner Mara spoke to him. The first time the Buddha was spoken to, and there's many times in the text, Mara said to the Buddha, when he was on his six-year quest to find enlightenment by sitting in the jungle alone, eating very little and practicing meditation, Mara said to him, whispered in his ear, "You are so thin and so pale, and you're probably near death too, but life is still possible. Live, Buddha, live. You can gain merit if you live out there in the world. What are you doing here? Relax yourself. Give up. What can you do by following this rough and difficult path?" This is in the Padhana Sutta. And his voice came into him in the guise of Namuchi, which is a sort of inner demon of there's not enough. There's never going to be enough. I don't have enough stuff. I don't have enough things. I won't be taken care of. So his voice is a very concerned one. And the Buddha replied, "Yes, the path is difficult, but none but the brave will conquer suffering and gain bliss through victory. Better to die struggling and find a path to happiness than to choose to live on in defeat." But before he said that, he did something very interesting, which he always did when he was engaged with these inner unskillful voices. He said, "Mara, I see you. Mara, I see you." Which means he didn't listen to the voices as if they were his own. He externalized them, gave them a personality, and then asked if this personality was skillful or not. We'll talk about that in a second, how to use that. Another time, Mara comes in an entirely different kind of attitude. Mara says, when the Buddha's injured his foot years later, and he's very old, and he's relaxing instead of teaching one day, and Mara comes to him and says, "What, are you weak and stupid? Why are you lying down? Aren't you supposed to be doing things in the world? What good is this resting in your secluded dwelling place? What good are you?" So the Buddha had a little bit of that self-hatred going on inside of him. And this time he says the exact same thing. He says, "Mara, I see you. I need to rest." So notice, on one occasion, Mara's saying, "Rest," and the Buddha says, "No, I can go on." And on another occasion, Mara is taking the exact opposite tack. He's saying, "Oh, you lazy son of a bitch, what are you doing? So what, you've injured yourself, you should be out there spreading the Dhamma." The point of it is that the Buddha knew what his own internal, unskillful voices sounded like. They were always judging. They were always harsh. They were always basically saying that whatever he was doing was never good enough. There was something else he should be doing. So he got to know what his unskillful voices sounded like, and he put it to the test. Okay, is this something that I would listen to if it was somebody else? Right? So think about what that would apply to our own thoughts. If you have a thought, if you could recognize what your unskillful voices sounded like in your head. In my head, my unskillful voices repeat themselves a lot. They're always shouting a little bit louder than the reasonable, thoughtful voices. And they're always drifting off into dour outcomes about what's going to happen in the future unless I follow them. My skillful thoughts like, oh, maybe I should meditate, or maybe I should go out for a bike ride or exercise or do something like that, they never repeat themselves. I've never repeated in my head over and over again, maybe I should exercise, maybe I should exercise. Doesn't ever happen. Never have I ever said, oh, I should meditate, I should meditate, I should meditate. It's not the way my mind works. But the thought, oh, I'm not going to have enough money for when I'm old. Oh my goodness, that thought can come along with a volume and a repetitiveness that you could not possibly imagine. So I've come to know that any thought that repeats itself over and over again, loudly, as the Buddha called it, papancha, is trying to make its outlandishness and the fact that it's not necessarily true seem more true by repeating itself. That's what the Buddha said, papancha, or repeating ourselves, is an attempt to make what's unreal seem real. So we repeat thoughts over and over again, worries over and over again, to make them seem more likely and more possible and more dangerous. So when I hear a thought that's repeating itself or promising a future outcome or speaking loudly or even speaking down to me, speaking in an unkind way, I know that's my own Mara. And I say basically the same thing. Ah, it's you again. This trick of not taking these thoughts as me immediately gets rid of the obligation of following them or listening to them or believing them. I have a new tool of what's called detaching from my thoughts. Because so long as I give them another name, and I give them another voice, they're no longer mine, and I can judge them. Another technique is imagining, would I say these thoughts to someone I cared about? Would I follow them around and say to them over and over again, you're not going to have enough money when you grow old. You've really blown it. You're fucked. Look how old you are and how little money you have in the bank. My goodness, what a bad decision you've made with your life. So, anyway, so that kind of stuff, you get it. It's test whether you would listen to somebody else say it to you. Would you say these thoughts to someone else? Do these voices sound all the same? Do they repeat themselves? Are they louder? Do they say things unkind to you? If they fall into any of those categories, they're unskillful thoughts and they're not worthy of thinking of them. If they're important, insist that your thoughts don't repeat themselves. Insist that you only listen to them if they speak in a calm voice and that they don't insult you, and that they would be in the exact same phrasing that you would talk to a friend. Insist upon it. Even if you think they've got the most important thing to say in the world, don't listen until they manage to phrase their message according to those simple rules. If you do, in the long term, you'll be much happier because you won't have trained your mind to freak out. One of the unnecessary things I've seen so many people do at work, at the various different places I've freelanced over the years, is that whenever we have a lot to do, a lot of us feel the need to get stressed out, to get anxious, to get, you know, worked up and bent out of shape, and we have a lot of things on our plate. The idea, I think, is that we've associated getting stressed out with getting things done. We feel we have a lot of things to do. If we're not stressed out, if we're not anxious, if we're not literally filled up with adrenaline and shaking and panicking to a certain degree, it means that we're not using all of our resources, that we're somehow slacking. Actually, I found out by my years of practice, I get just as much done totally relaxed and just thinking of the next thing to do as I do panicking and worrying. In fact, I tend to get a lot more done if I don't think about in my mind all the things I have to do and how I'll never, ever get them done. I tend to be much more effective if I just say, okay, I'm just going to focus on one thing at a time, and however it comes out, that's how it comes out. That's the most effective way I work. So finally, for tonight, the last technique of knowing when a thought is worthwhile or not is, imagine that your thoughts are a movie and you're in a movie theater. Most of the time when we're in movies that are scary, the movie screen is the thing that we're living entirely within. We're watching the horror movie and we're completely identifying with the character on the screen in our mind, saying, don't go into the cellar, or don't go down the stairs, or don't go into that house alone, or don't go into that closet, or don't do this, or don't do that. And of course they do exactly that. And we get stressed out because all of our awareness is entirely trapped within the screen. If you ever, however, want to break the fear or the pull of a movie, what you have to do is very simple. You look around. You see the fact that you're in a movie theater, that there are other people there, and that it's not real, right? That it's all a two-dimensional projection that, in fact, you have climbed inside of. The same thing goes with thoughts. No matter how real they seem, there's always something called a body which is going on at the same time. Yes, you have a body. Beneath all of your thoughts, all of your fears, all of your worries, every last daydream, fantasy, concern, doubt, or projection, there's always been something that is underlying it. The physical feeling of the body and the breath. And if we become aware of it, practicing relaxing the body and keeping the breath comfortable, that's the exact same way of pulling our minds away from the movie screen that we've been living in, the two-dimensional thought worlds with all the stories about how bad things or how dangerous things or how promising everything or how great it's going to be when I get this job or this relationship or this new apartment or whatever. Whenever we find ourselves living inside of a thought, if we practice breathing, keeping the breath calm, opening our awareness to which parts of the body get tight and breathing into them, we're no longer trapped by the movie. That doesn't mean that the movie has stopped playing any more than when you're in a movie theater and you look around and you remind yourself, oh, right, I'm in a movie. This is not really happening right now. It doesn't mean that the movie stopped playing. It's still there. You can still follow the plot and still actually become aware of how skillfully it's made. It's just that you don't believe it's true when you pull your eyes away from the screen. The same thing happens when you do this to a thought. If you pull your eyes away from the internal claustrophobic thought world and become aware of your body and your breath, you're also introducing doubt as to whether that thought is true or not. Another thing that becomes clear is you'll be able to see if the thought is causing you physical stress. And this is very important. A thought that is skillful, a thought that is generally an important thought to have, will happen in the frontal lobe, and it's not going to cause underlying physical stress in the parts of your body that hold stress. The only kinds of thoughts that do that are fear thoughts and craving thoughts that are triggered by the amygdala. And the amygdala is not the most important part of the brain to engage when you're making a decision or thinking about something. So if you notice that the body is very tight or the breath becomes shallow when you're thinking about something, it's a good tip that you're engaging in a thought that is based on or is promulgated by a part of the brain that's not the smartest part, that you're not actually using your frontal lobe. You're using the older limbic system in your thinking. So practice relaxing the body. If you can think the thought without getting the body tense or the breath disrupted, it means that it's a thought that you can think. It's not one that you have to abandon. So again, just to wrap up, here's some of the things to ask ourselves. Do I know that the thought is true? Is there a possibility I could be making a mistake, remembering that everything I experience is subjective? Is this thought ever led to skillful results in the past? Have I seen that worrying about the future of what other people think about me or what might happen, do these ever lead to skillful results? Is this a skillful process? If not, abandon it. Is this the time to think about this? Late at night, when I need to worry about or think about something else, when I need to just relax? Is this the time that I should be thinking about this? Is this thought Mara? Is this my unskillful voices in my head? Is it shouting at me, yelling, repeating, berating me? Is it something that is acting in a way that I would never act to another human being? If so, don't listen to it. Is this thought something that I've climbed entirely inside it? Have I abandoned the body? Have I forgotten about my breath? Am I unaware of all the other things that are going on around me? These are the tests. And sometime I'm going to give you the 5 ways of getting rid of obsessive thoughts. But that's not for tonight. But anyway, I hope tonight was in some way useful, and thanks for listening. So now's your time to... Oh, all right.
I might be asking about part 2, but...